What I wanted to do today was just describe the basic motivations behind the book that I just wrote, and some of the very cursory arguments, a cursory overview of the arguments that I try and raise in about 20 minutes. So I started writing the book in 2006 in response to what was quickly developing as two caricatures of the Evo Morales government that just was elected in December 2005, at least caricatures as I saw them in both the international media and also in the original scholarly work that originally started to come out. One caricature on the right basically engaged in a kind of ritualized demonization of Evo Morales as a authoritarian populist threat to liberal democracy and the proper functioning of capitalist markets, and particularly a challenge to neoliberalism, and the other, and also in alliance with the other sort of bogeyman of the region, Hugo Chavez, who was seen to be the sort of sponsor of all change in Bolivia, along with Fidel Castro and a sort of an evil axis of the Latin American and Caribbean region. That was one caricature that is still very common in both the liberal and conservative media internationally. And then, on the other hand, you had a caricature of certain left formulations about the significance of what was going on under Evo Morales in the Bolivian context. And that's what I'm most interested in talking about today, because we're at a conference called Historical Materialism, and I assume that we all reject the first caricature. So the second one is more problematic because there's a tendency to romanticize and to accept straightforwardly the kinds of image promotion done by Morales around his government, and to sort of repeat in the crudest ways the kinds of arguments that are made in presidential press releases and then distributed through the press that's aligned with Morales. And so I want to kind of challenge these two characters, but particularly focusing on the left one in the time that I have. So the basic thing to understand, I think, is that Bolivia was at the cutting edge of anti-neoliberal resistance in Latin America in the first part of this century, and that Latin America, in turn, was the region of the world most militantly resisting the neoliberal phase of capitalism. And that Bolivia, in particular, started what I call a left indigenous cycle of revolt that lasted between 2000 and 2005. And it began with the Cochabamba water war against privatization in that city, which was really the first victory of left indigenous forces after 15 years of right-wing assault. One of the most orthodox neoliberal programs was introduced in Bolivia in 1985, crushing the tin miners who had been the historical leading force of the labor movement and the left more generally, who were dispersed almost 90% of the workers into various shanty towns on the edges of the major cities, and then others were re-peasantized in a particular way that I'll talk about in a moment. But that was really the beginning, the first, because they reversed the privatization of water, which was a World Bank-driven project, and that renewed the kinds of ideas that the confidence of left indigenous sectors that they could re-articulate and actually have a say in the self-determination of the popular classes in the Bolivian context. And this really led, over the next 5 years, I mean, there's a whole bunch of details that I'll have to jump over, but it led slowly and then increasingly rapidly to rural and urban rebellions, culminating in the 2003-2005 so-called gas wars, which were called gas wars because of the centrality of the demand to renationalize the natural gas industries, Bolivia having the second largest deposits in South America after Venezuela. But there was much more to it than simply a demand to renationalize gas. This entailed, in both cases, 3 weeks of general strikes in the city of El Alto, which is basically a contiguous city with La Paz, basically the shanty town on the edge of the capital. They dug up the streets. There was complete blockade of basic commerce coming in and out of La Paz. You had 500,000 people occupy the capital, and you overthrew two presidents in under 2 years. Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada in October 2003, probably the most hated president in recent living memory, and then Carlos Mesa 14 months later in 2005. And all of this was really the basis for the successful bid by Evo Morales to become the first indigenous president of the country in December 2005 as leader of Movimiento Socialismo, a movement towards socialism party, and then to be re-elected 4 years later in December 2009 elections with 64% of the popular vote on a 90% turnout, which were both extraordinary numbers that were totally unprecedented in Bolivian history. So part of the caricature of the left that part is not very controversial, what I just said, but it's more about what Morales represents after this. And some of the caricature relies or stems from the fact that sort of history begins with the election of Morales rather than this entire cycle that made it possible for him to come into office. And before I make this sort of more controversial argument that he represented something more like the damming of that flood than the sort of culmination of it, I want to say a little bit more about this 2005 period, theoretically. So what I call it is a combined liberation struggle over this period, a very unique combination of what I see to be the two most prominent cultures of popular opposition in the historical development of Bolivia. One searching back to the arrival of the Spanish, but really in its sort of most dramatic form, the 1781 rebellion against the Spanish led by Tupac Katari. And the traditions of indigenous resistance stretching up all the way to the current period. And when, this might seem very far back to go to understand the 2005 period, but in the streets of La Paz and El Alto, the name of Tupac Katari is regularly invoked, as are all kinds of indigenous heroes of various anti-colonial struggles throughout the period. Particularly Katari's slogan, or not slogan, but his last words before being drawn and quartered by the Spanish, which was "I'm one man, but I'll return as millions." And the people in the streets of La Paz see themselves in the return of Tupac Katari and the tradition of that anti-colonial resistance. So obviously there are many different indigenous currents and resistance practices over those centuries that I'm not going to delineate, but let's just say that there are many of them that are informing what was going on in the current period. And the other tradition is a much more recent phenomenon with the beginning of the phase of tin-led capitalism in the late 19th century, but really taking off in the early 20th century, and the history of revolutionary Marxism that developed in the tin mines, particularly traditions of Trotskyism, but also traditions of anarcho-syndicalism, and so on. And so these two traditions were not always working in tandem with each other over various historical periods. Sometimes they worked together at various junctures in Bolivian history, but really with no there's no precedent for the ways in which left indigenous traditions came together in the 2000-2005 period. And I want to suggest that part of that particular rearticulation that happened was because of the ways in which neoliberal capitalism restructured the working class and restructured the peasantry. I'm not going to have a great deal of time to talk about it, but part of the story is that El Alto, the shanty town where I did most of my work, is one expression of this, so I'll just talk about it for a second. Basically, you had many of the relocated miners from the privatization of tin mines from 1985 made their way to El Alto and brought the revolutionary Marxist traditions that they learned in the mines and the democratic militant unionism that they learned in the mines into a very, very different context, dominated by an informal economy, small production sites, people selling chiclets part of the day and working in various small shoe apparel factories, whatever, during other parts of the day and so on. So very heterogeneous working class formation on the edge of the capital. So it took, I mean, the ways in which organizing happened didn't rearticulate themselves immediately, but you can see the traditions of revolutionary miners articulated in new ways in this very novel context in the early 21st century. The other tradition that was brought, that happened in another form of dispossession that happened almost simultaneously to the tin miners was the dispossession, particularly of the Aymara peasantry of the Western Altiplano or the High Plateau. And you see the shantytown of the Altiplano, in addition to being to having neighborhoods named after mining communities and to having statues of mining proletarian heroes from earlier epochs, is also 82% self-identified as indigenous in the last census in 2001. So you have a very particular working class formation that is informed by its indigeneity and really calls into question some of the accounts of Bolivia that rely on what I see to be a somewhat romantic notion of indigenous people as primarily rural, primarily in the Bolivian context today, when in fact there are primarily urban, Bolivia is now almost 70% an urban country, and people don't lose their indigeneity when they come to the cities of this instance. So the traditions of Aymara radicalism and revolutionary Marxism combined in this very unique way to demand over this period an anti-capitalist resistance eventually by 2003-2005, that is to say the end of class exploitation, the all kinds of visions of a classless society coming out from these revolts. I did a series of interviews to reflect this. It wasn't just my imaginations and projections. I mean, they're very anti-capitalist ideas and goals coming out of those rebellions. But there was also a deeply indigenous liberation aspect to those demands expressed in a whole number of ways. But the important thing is the way in which the activists couldn't even, they were cognitively incapable of separating these ideas of anti-capitalist resistance and indigenous liberation from what was basically an informal apartheid culture of race relations in the country, with a 62% indigenous majority making up most of the peasantry and the working class, pitted against a primarily white but also mixed race ruling class. And so the racialized character of capitalism determined in the particularity of the Bolivian social formation determined the form in which resistance took. The other thing I want to say about that period is to define it as an authentic revolutionary epic. And what I mean by that is two things were happening that allow us to call this a revolutionary epic. One basically a phenomenon from above and the other from below. The context from above was a crisis of the ruling class that was both economic and then expressed politically. So between 1998 and 2002, the country, as part of a wider recession in South America, the worst recession since 1982, beginning of the debt crisis that started in Mexico, you have the worst recession in Bolivia since the early 80s. And this came on the end of 15 years of neoliberal restructuring, which saw increases in unemployment, increases in poverty, dispossession of peasant land, all of these factors that are commonly associated with these processes. But the promises of neoliberalism and the chasm between those promises and what was being realized after 15 years was getting very difficult to sustain. And already, and then when the crisis hit of the late 1990s, early 2000s, the left responded for the first time it was capable of in the first of a water war, as I suggested. So this was the economic crisis that was calling into question the legitimacy of neoliberalism and it obviously wasn't unique to Bolivia in the sense that there was a crisis of neoliberal legitimacy throughout South America, expressed in various extra-parliamentary and parliamentary forms. The political expression of the ruling class crisis at the time was the implosion, basically, of the three parties that had been implicated in the implementation of neoliberalism, the ADN, the MIR, and the MNR. And their ability to reproduce themselves electorally was falling in every election since the late 1990s, but they were really in a crisis situation by the early 2000s. And even though there was no left party alternative to counter them at that time. And so that was what was happening from above, which is very important to this dynamic of a revolutionary epoch. And from below, though, as I've already sort of described, and I'm also spend less time on, was this resurgence of different forms, both urban and rural, of this combined liberation struggle. So by revolutionary epoch, I mean there was the possibility of a fundamental transformation of state, society, and economy growing out of this indigenous insurrectionary process. But as we'll see, a revolutionary epoch doesn't imply the inevitability of that social revolution coming out of a revolutionary epoch. And so the rest of my 5 minutes will talk about the period of the failure of that revolutionary epoch to transform itself into a social revolution. So the reason why I think Morales represents a damming of the flood in certain respects has to do with the changing character of the party that he was a part of, the Movement Towards Socialism Party, which began as at least a militantly anti-neoliberal party, and you could argue in some respects an anti-capitalist party, certainly an anti-imperialist party based in the Chapare region of the Department of Cochabamba. A particular form of smallholding peasants were basically the basis of that party, and I say they were particular because they were growing coca for the cocaine market and were then subject to the militarization of their and dispossession of their crops constantly under the auspices of the war on drugs. When in fact, they were responding to the basic idea of comparative advantage of neoliberalism, where you grow what you can grow most cheaply and sell most dearly on the national market, which was cocaine in that period. So it was out of this conflict with the Drug Enforcement Agency, of the militarization of their livelihoods and so on, unsurprisingly, the Cocaleros developed a very powerful anti-imperialist ideology, which was rooted in the defense of the coca leaf, because coca, although this coca was being produced for cocaine, coca had all kinds of traditional uses as well, which linked them to all kinds of indigenous struggles and ways of articulating the struggle in an indigenous way. But it was basically the party of Movement Towards Socialism grew out of this milieu, as did Evo Morales himself. But by 2002, and so over that period, it was primarily an extra-parliamentary party rooted in mobilizing and building a mass base in the streets and the countryside, playing a major role, for example, in the 2000 Cochabamba Water War. But then 2002 happens, Evo Morales almost wins those elections as a fluke event, following in part because of a gift by Manuel Proca, the U.S. ambassador, who called Evo Morales and the Cocaleros the next Taliban of South America, and so on, stoking the kind of nationalism that led Evo Morales to go from about 4% popularity 3 weeks before those elections to 21%, putting him within 1% during those elections. Now, at that point, it doesn't just happen overnight, but almost overnight, a party that had no possibility of contending for national power in through elections was suddenly seen as the largest single party in the country. With a major possibility of winning the 2007 elections, and it gets flooded with all kinds of opportunists from other existing neoliberal parties, from the MNR, the MIR, the ADN, and so on. All kinds of NGO folks start entering this. The leadership layer of the Movement Towards Socialism, if you look at it over its changing over this period changes quite dramatically from being led by cocoleros to being led by basically an urban middle class and a principally white layer of activists, although with Morales at the top. And it focuses then on winning the elections of 2007, which were then pushed up to 2005. But elections become its primary objective, and in the 2003-2005 gas wars that I briefly described, the movement for socialism plays essentially no role. Rank-and-file activists within the party do play a role, but to the extent that the party plays a role, it's in negotiating a constitutional exit rather than a revolutionary exit to that, to those two crises. But there was no articulated political expression of the left, to the left of that party, while the movement had a tremendous capacity to self-organize and to mobilize. Once the question of power was raised, there was really no capacity to carry through. And in that situation, so there was a tremendous amount of counter power that had been developed against the existing state. But then you had essentially a situation in which Morales negotiated a movement out of the elections, and Morales is elected with extraordinary support because the alternative at the time was a fascist right wing based on the Eastern Lowlands. That's probably 5 minutes. But
we have about an hour left in the panel, so if you want
to... Just 20 seconds, so just to say, because I meant to talk about, and I can sort of defend the position, but I tried to in the book the idea that if you look at the basic political economic indicators of this whole period, there's very, very minimal evidence that there's been, or no evidence that there's been a break, a fundamental break with the neoliberal orthodoxies that were introduced, that he inherited. And so we can talk about what was possible, because the other alternative argument that I disagree with is that the sort of impediments of global capitalism and the imperatives of how a subordinated country operates within this world system made it impossible to move forward. But for a number of reasons that I don't have time to get to, I think that there was more space for a challenge than actually transpired. Thanks.